Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. A former Young Australian of the Year, Sarah's 20 years as a nurse and humanitarian have taken her around the globe. This has given her a uniquely human perspective to the way we think, work and behave. She has seen the power of human connection to literally save lives. By cultivating a culture of courage, we all have the power to make an impact. Tune in as we talk with Sarah about her humanitarian travels, her coping mechanisms for mental well-being in challenging situations, and tackling burnout in the workplace and cultivating a culture of courage. Welcome, Sarah.
Welcome to another episode of Pebble in the Pond. I'm your host, Talitha Natt. And today we are coming to you from the Workplace Mental Health Symposium up on the Gold Coast. And it's my pleasure to be sat here this afternoon for a chat with the lovely Sarah Morse. Now, I'll give you a little bit of an introduction into Sarah's background, which is very impressive, might I add. Sarah is a former New South Wales Young Australian of the Year, and she draws on 20 years' experience as a nurse and a humanitarian to bring a uniquely global and deeply human perspective to the way humans think, work, and behave. Now, there was a snippet in Sarah's bio that really caught me and I just loved every word of it and I'll read it out to you. It says, Sarah is known for her deep commitment to nursing the human spirit, and I absolutely adore that. Sarah, it's lovely to have you here this afternoon. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Sarah's just actually flown in from Melbourne and is joining us as a keynote speaker this afternoon and hopefully enjoying some time by the pool this afternoon before flying back to Sydney tomorrow. So why don't you tell the audience a bit about your background in terms of where you started, because it's quite an interesting background from what I can see, and then we'll get into the chat from there.
Sure. So yeah, I've had quite a varied leadership journey, I guess. So I started off as a nurse and humanitarian. When I was 17, I won a World Vision Study tour to Zimbabwe and Zambia, and that was just a trip that completely changed my life. It was my first time to encounter poverty. It was my first time to realize just how lucky I was in the family and the situation that I'd been born into. And so I decided after that that I would do everything I could to make an impact to the people that I had met and people like them.
Amazing. And talk to me about your time as a nurse. So you specialized in cancer services and palliative care. That's obviously quite, I would say, the words come to mind would be heavy areas of nursing to care for those. Can you tell me a bit about your experience on the floor there?
Yeah, getting into cancer nursing was something that I didn't want to do. I actually wanted to run completely in the opposite direction, mainly because my family had been affected by cancer. So I had a brother who died of leukemia when he was 5, before I was born. But basically the grief and the impact of that I had grown up with in my family for my whole life. So doing cancer nursing was not on my radar at all. So it was a very big shock when I found myself on my very first rotation as a new grad nurse on a hematology ward looking after people with leukemia. And it was a lot. I was only, I think, 20 when I graduated from nursing. So just still really young. But what I found very early on in that placement was because I understood grief and my parents were really trailblazers in the grief space. So they started Compassionate Friends, which is a support group for bereaved parents. So I had a really deep understanding of grief and being able to sit with people and not sort of making, you know, blasé comments or things like that, but being able to sit with people in their sorrow. And I really found that that was where I was the best nurse. And so I've been in lots and lots of different roles, but I always circle back to cancer nursing because that's where I feel like I'm able to offer the most to my patients.
That's quite incredible. How many years did you work in the cancer area before you moved on to palliative care?
Well, that's a tricky question because my life is my life is very much not linear. Mm-hmm. So I've been nursing for 20 years on and off. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I've had lots of varied roles. So some of those are here in Australia, some are overseas as a humanitarian. And my most recent role here in Australia was in palliative care. So yeah, I guess it's not a linear story by any means. So it's hard to count the number of years or the amount of time. But again, in palliative care, that's where I was really able to really sit with people and see the holistic care, not just for the patient, but for their family as well, which is so important in palliative care.
Yeah, for sure. Can you tell me about this snippet in your bio that just really struck me about nursing the human spirit? What does that mean to you?
What that really means to me is really understanding that everybody has a human spirit. So whether it's, you know, actually nursing, working as a clinical nurse, but listening to people just in everyday life, in the workplace, you know, as we go about our lives and humanitarian and my family, you know, that everybody has that human spirit. And it needs looking after, it needs care, it needs empathy, it needs compassion. And I think when we stop looking at people through that lens, that's where we stop having empathy for other people.
And where do you, or what are one of the areas that you would say when it comes to nursing the human spirit that we as a society are dropping the ball on? I'm sure there's many areas, but if you could narrow it down to one specific area, what would that be?
Sure. I just read a statistic just this week saying that one in four Australians are suffering from loneliness. And I think that statistic is really sad.
Yeah.
For a country that has so much resources, we have so much available to us. And yet many, many people are sitting on the sidelines and feeling lonely, and especially post-COVID.
Yeah, I was about to ask, is that statistic post-COVID? Because I would imagine that maybe, I mean, it would be frightful to think if that stat is higher since we had the COVID isolation piece. But I mean, one in four is very sad, isn't it?
Yeah, that was a recent stat from just a few months ago.
Wow.
So I think what COVID did was where people were already isolated, made them more isolated. Then we've got people working from home, and some people love it, and some people, it's a really big place of isolation, and people are struggling to connect and find that place of connection in society.
Mm. I would love to know about the work that you do in the humanitarian space. Can you tell us how you got into that area and what you did?
Sure. Again, long and varied story to lots of different roles. So the first one was that trip to Africa when I was 17, and just really being exposed to poverty and seeing the impact of poverty on people's lives. So after that, I did a lot of short-term trips, going over, taking teams over to places like Ecuador and Greece, Indonesia as well. I did a two-year stint in an orphanage in Romania, looking after children who had been neglected and abandoned. And then most recently, I worked in a safe house for survivors of human trafficking in Spain.
That's quite incredible work to do. I've got a question around, how do you cope mentally with what you see on the ground in different countries with the effects of poverty or whatever situations they're going for? That would be a lot for most people to try and grapple with. What did you do to make sure that your mental well-being was cared for?
I probably wasn't that great at it, to be honest, in the beginning. And so I came back from Romania with pretty severe burnout, which is why I'm passionate about talking about burnout now. So that's what I'll be talking about this afternoon at the conference, is how we can actually tackle burnouts, because 80% of the workforce are currently saying that they feel burnt out, and that's across all sectors. So, you know, it's something that's very real for a lot of people. So, in the beginning, I wasn't great at it. I just gave too much of myself. I didn't have enough boundaries. I used to work super long days. And yeah, returned from Romania pretty damaged and pretty burnt out. And so I had to learn how to put those boundaries in place and how to care for myself. Because back 20 years ago, that wasn't even really a conversation that we were having. Mm. So the same thing with nursing, learning how to put those barriers in place so that I can look after myself as well.
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of advice would you give to someone who is in a similar situation, they're feeling like they could be heading down the burnout trajectory. What would be some of the warning signs that you would say to people to look out for?
Yeah, I actually have a really cool story around that. When I got back from Romania, the organization I was working with paired me up with this amazing mentor called Yvonne. She was a very kind, very generous lady, and she donated her time for 2 weeks every 2 weeks for about, I don't know, a long time. I was pretty messed up, like 4 years or something. So I was seeing her for free. But this one day I arrived at her place really late. I was about half an hour late, and I arrived at her front door. And I'm like, oh, sorry. And she just wouldn't let me in the front door. And she's like, this is so rude. Why are you late? You know, I'm giving up my time for you. This is so disrespectful. And I was really shocked because nobody had ever set that kind of boundary with me before. Mm-hmm. So that was my first time to really see boundaries in action. And I mean, she was feisty. And she said, why are you late? And I said, well, I ran out of petrol and my mobile phone battery was dead, so I couldn't call you. And, you know, sorry, I won't do it again, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, yeah, you won't do it again. And you're not coming inside today. And she said, here's a tip for you. When your petrol tank is a quarter full, stop and fill up. You don't have to wait for the light to go on before you put petrol in your car. And that was revolutionary information for me as a young 20-something year old. I thought, no, I didn't know that you could just, you know, fill up your car earlier. But then she said something and that stuck with me for the last 20 years. She said, and when your emotional tank gets to a quarter full, you learn to read the signs of a quarter full and stop and fill up. Mm. So it's too late. Once the tank's empty, once we're in that burnout zone, you know, those signs and symptoms can be quite catastrophic. You know, we know that the stress cycle and the cortisol cycle actually impacts every single body system over time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the list of symptoms of burnout is enormous. But if we can learn to recognize the symptoms at a quarter full, what does our body start doing? How do we start feeling when we're getting low, when our emotional tank is getting too empty, and then stop then and fill up so that we don't run out of petrol long term? So that's something, a lesson that I've carried with me ever since then.
It's a great analogy, isn't it? Because you would never drive your car on an empty tank. It wouldn't physically be able to, but we expect our bodies to be able to do the same. So can I just confirm, you said that 80% of the workforce across various industries are saying they are experiencing or feeling like they are burnt out.
They are experiencing burnout. So that was from a recent study from the Australian HR Institute, and they surveyed thousands of people across lots of different industries, and the same stat kept coming back. So I speak a lot to nurses about burnout, and the same is true for nurses, so around 80% of nurses. But across industries, you know, I spoke to women in construction, I spoke to people in events, I spoke to nurses in aged care yesterday, and that's all just in the last couple of weeks. And when I say that stat, everybody nods their head and says, yep, that's us.
That's far too high, isn't it?
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little about your presentation this afternoon when you're going to be touching on burnout? What are some of the key frameworks or prevention measures that organizations can put in place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when I think about resilience, I think about it as sort of a two-sided scale. So on one side, we've got that proactive organizational investment. And of course, with the new psychosocial safety laws as well, that's another step that companies by law need to take in order to ensure that their culture and their environment does offer that psychosocial safety. But things like, you know, regulating work hours, making sure people are taking adequate breaks. If people are working from home, working out how to be intentional about connection. And that's a big one that I talk about, because often people are thinking, you know, especially with, you know, people working sometimes from home, sometimes in the office. And it's like, oh, we'll just wait till everyone gets in the office till we have a get together. And then there never is that day.
Yeah.
You know, and I've heard of people thinking, oh, I'll go into the office, and they get there and there's no one there, you know. So really being intentional about that connection. So that's what I'm talking a lot about this afternoon is how can we be intentional both online and in the office space as well? So one thing that we do on our team is every time we meet, we have a time of connection.
Yeah.
So whatever we're meeting about, first 5 minutes is always about connection. And then every week we have our team meeting where we spend an hour connecting with each other and just hearing about each other's lives. So it's very tempting when we're on Zoom, we just log on, start the meeting, log off, and then that's the end of the conversation. But if that was in the office, you know, you'd have the time walking to the meeting. You'd have time to have those chats, you know, and then, you know, maybe grab some lunch after the meeting or things like that. So when we're in the office together, it can be a little bit more organic. But when we're working in a hybrid environment, we really need to get intentional about that connection. So I think that's one side of the scale, is that proactive organisational investment. But on the other side is also our own commitment to our own self-care. So you can't expect that your mental health is solely in the hands of your workplace or your employer. That on the other side, we have to be looking at our self-care. So looking at, when are we getting to a quarter full, learning to recognise our body, building in things that are looking after ourselves. And sometimes when we say self-care, people think, oh, I don't have time for a day spa, or how am I expect, I can't take a holiday, so I can't do self-care. But thinking through, we break it down into five main sections, which is the physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, and then the indulgence. Mm. So that indulgence sometimes, but really looking at what are you doing physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually as well, to make sure that your mental health is in a good place. So One of the things that I do, I go for a half hour walk every morning. And so for me, that ticks off all those boxes. It's physical, it's emotional. So I spend the time just, you know, thinking through the day, kind of debriefing from the previous day. You know, it's mental, so I'm preparing myself also for the day, doing my affirmations. Spiritually, is that time to pray and you know, meditate, do my affirmations. And then the indulgence also feels like, you know, a break for my kids for half an hour as well. So it feels a little bit indulgent as well. So working in things like that into our lives, which, you know, seem to be small, but over time can have a really big impact. And I know for myself, my own mental health, if I don't do those walks, my mental health starts to go downhill pretty quickly. So working out what it is for you. For some people, it's swimming. For some people, it's, you know, meeting up with a friend. So that's another thing I've added into my day. So I'm an extrovert. Love people. My husband's an introvert. So he finds working from home amazing. He loves it. I find it very lonely. So I started working into my day morning coffees. So most mornings I meet up with a school mum or a friend or a new friend. So somebody that I've met online, and have an online coffee. Yeah. In order to sort of get myself going for the day as well. Mm. So that's a structure that I've built in. So 8:30 till 9:30 is like, you know, coffee and chat that. Kind of time.
That's so great for the connection piece, isn't it? I was listening to a panel this morning here, and the Chief Mental Health Officer of Australia Post is talking about connection and how important it is in terms of Maslow's, is it purpose or structure that he has in regards to how human connection is absolutely at the top of the chain. And without it, we tend to lose a sense of self and community. And I think the remote working is certainly really challenging us to work out how we do that properly. And the panel also mentioned that we had, as I mentioned, Australia Post, and we also had Woolworths on board, and they were quite open in saying that they don't have the hybrid model nailed yet, in their words. And I think that gives some people hope that not everyone has the perfect scenario in regards to what works best from hybrid or flexible working or remote working. Can I just ask you another question in regards to, I guess, well-being at work? In your opinion, what programs, tools, and resources would be your top three that you would want to see companies implement to look after employees' well-being and mental health, or both?
Well, obviously mine. So I do have
good answer.
I do have an online course around cultivating culture of courage. And also in-person delivery as well. So That's what I talk about, cultivating culture of courage. So courage is an acronym. So C is for connection, O is for outward focus, U is for unity, R is for resilience, A is for authenticity, G is for gratitude, and E is for empathy. And so what I do is work with companies on how we can integrate those seven elements into their workplace culture. And again, it's the small things. So I recently ran a workshop with inside a company. And so I did two workshops. I did one, asked everyone to go and implement some things. And then a few months later, I came back and we revisited it. And what was really struck me was the people who implemented, it was really small changes. So for example, one person wrote down they were going to work on gratitude. And when I asked him to unpack that, he said, well, I just started thanking people for stuff. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, I've been here 15 years and I don't think I've ever thanked anyone.
Wow.
And I was like, wow. Okay. So, and the difference that that made to his team when he got proactive about gratitude was incredible. So, you know, his team, all of a sudden, they started enjoying coming to work. They knew when they'd done something well. You know, he was saying he had a really high bar of expectation. So he'd only thank people once the project was finished. Mm-hmm. And then people didn't understand week to week what they'd done well, what they had done wrong. And so we're very defensive when it came to critical feedback as well. Mm. So he noticed that just in that short time frame, in the 3 months that they were practicing it, that when he was being grateful to his staff every day, then when he had some constructive feedback, it was they were much less defensive and much better received. So things like that that we're looking at, what small changes can you make in your workplace to actually impact those? But obviously there's so many resources out there. And I just walked past the Are You Okay stand here and, you know, amazing resource packs that they have on having those conversations with people and really, you know, being open to being authentic and expressing empathy in work as well. Mm. So, you know, reaching out to those companies that already have those existing programs. But I'm a big believer that it doesn't even take a program. Sometimes it just takes that mindset shift to start thinking about, okay, how can we get intentional about connection?
Yeah.
You know, how can we have an outward focus, looking out at the world rather than just looking at ourselves and things like that? So, yeah, I mean, there's so many programs out there. I can't think of any more off the top of my head, but so many great ones. But, you know, sometimes it's just about being intentional and making those micro changes, which actually make a big impact over time.
I'd love to know your thoughts around, there's been some discussion here at the conference about EAP programs and 24/7 programs, for example, that Sonder roll out with larger organizations typically. My question is, for an employee who is experiencing mental distress with regards to any situation in any industry, what would be your ideal process or opportunities that the employee can engage with? Is it an EAP program? Do you feel like that would be the first step or line of defense? Or do you feel like we need to have a much more holistic and comprehensive process in place to be able to intervene before the employee gets to that point of the distress, I guess, red button moment?
Yes, definitely. So I think that's where working on the culture from the beginning, being proactive about investing in the culture to stop people getting from that place of psychosocial distress. But once somebody is in that place, I'm a strong believer that it should be a professional. One of the risks of that in the workplace is if we're just as colleagues just trying to help each other, you know, one of the risks is then vicarious trauma or, you know, triggering another colleague. So for example, if someone is suicidal and the colleague doesn't know what to do, you know, that can be quite a traumatic situation. So I think for people who are in psychological distress, I think speaking to a professional is a good line. We know that EAP programs have a very low uptake overall. And when I was burnt out in my last role as a nurse, I didn't call EAP. And I just wonder why I didn't. Mm. I don't know why I didn't. It felt too hard. It felt like I didn't know who to call. I didn't know what the process was. But they offered free help for spouses as well, or partners as well. So I, you know, that would have been really helpful. And I kind of regret that I didn't. I think I was just in such a muddle. I just couldn't even think.
Yep.
And I didn't want to ask my boss about where's the number, or I probably should have. She was very kind. That would have been fine. Mm-hmm. So I think we should be accessing EAP much, much more than we are. It's there. Our companies are paying for it.
Yep.
And that person, if they don't know what to do, they'll know where to refer you at least.
Sure.
Whereas just talking to a colleague about serious mental health issues that you might be struggling with, that colleague might not be equipped and it might actually cause them damage. So we need to be very careful as well. Yes, we need empathy. Yes, we need connection. But then we also need to have professionals involved as well.
Absolutely. Final question for you, because I'm very much aware that we need to get you over to the stage shortly for your keynote presentation, which is very exciting. But I was just sitting here thinking about, I wonder what your time in the humanitarian space and your travels overseas, you've obviously had some incredible experiences in some really amazing locations. What skills and attributes and experiences did you bring from your humanitarian work to your work in your current workplace?
So I guess the whole thing, like the whole, everything that I have experienced in the last 20 years is what I'm now bringing into workplaces across Australia. So my understanding of cross-cultural work, so for a little while I was a cross-cultural trainer as well, and really understanding how to work with different cultures. And so the way that I look at it is that workplace culture is exactly the same as if we were getting ready to go into, you know, an African village. There's certain cultural norms, there's certain things that we have to adjust to. And so workplace culture is just another culture. And so if we look at it like that, you know, it's just about learning the rules. It's learning how things are done in this place. and exactly the same as if I was going to go out into an African village or something like that. So that deep understanding of culture and the way that people think, work and behave, as we said in the intro, is something that I'm very passionate about. And I think we don't talk enough about here in Australia. I think we want to be multicultural and we want to celebrate diversity, but at the same time, we're not kind of courageous enough to actually have those conversations about, you know, well, how do you perceive that? Or, you know, what happens if you've got two different cultures in the room and one person is perceiving leadership in one way and another person? So actually having those conversations and be brave to have those courageous conversations. So yeah, and learning just to sit with people, not trying to have all the answers straight away, but learning to sit with people and have a more collaborative process in terms of understanding how we can change workplace culture as well.
I love it. Great answer. It's been a pleasure to speak with you this afternoon, Sarah. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Welcome.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.